Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview that I did with Steve Druckmann, playwright, scholar, teacher, journalist, all-around writer, and creative human being. But it took Steve a while to allow himself to discover that really the through line for him is playwriting. It wasn't so obvious to him, although maybe it should have been. Listen to how Steve's unconscious tricked him into discovering that he is first and foremost a playwright. Also, hear a review by Pam Wiley of the world premiere of Steve's play, The Innocents, at the Oslo Repertory Theater. So hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice. Gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive. From nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about you and me, the real you and me, not the you and me that most of us are pretending to be, the you and me that we show to the world, the you and me that we believe is all there is to us. As a psychotherapist and also as a kind of observer of, well, just observer, I have seen that my clients, my friends, everybody that I can see is keeping secrets about themselves, secrets about who they are and what they can do, what they believe, secrets about their failings and flaws and difficulties. And as I say over and over, so if you've been listening to the show, you've heard this a lot, I'm not just talking here about the kinds of things that we pretend, that we know we're keeping secrets about. And the example I love to give is, you know, laughing at a joke you don't understand because you don't want people to know you don't understand it. That kind of secret. Or what I used to do before I was aware of my dyslexia and I understood that there was nothing I could do about it, I would pretend that I could do things that other people could do that I can't do. I have no sense of direction. I get lost all the time. I can't type. I have a kind of spatial dyslexia that keeps me from remembering visually where things are. So if I take something out of the cupboard, I don't remember where it goes. I can't see it. You know, other people can do that. So for many years, I pretended that I could do these things because I was embarrassed. And I didn't want other people to know that this was true of me. But that's not the kind of secrets that I'm talking about here. Here, I am talking about secrets that we actually keep from ourselves. The reality that we learn very young what it is that does and what it is that doesn't work in our either our family of origin or in school or in our church sometimes or in our peer group. And having discovered that this quality doesn't work, we start out pretending in the way that I was just describing, and over time we simply forget. We forget that things hurt our feelings. We forget that we can be angry. We forget that we can be assertive and stand up for ourselves. I don't know how many clients I've had where I ask them the question, well, what do you want? And they say, oh, I don't know. I don't know what I want. I've never known what I want. And I always have to remind them that that can't possibly be true. Anyone who's ever seen a toddler knows that we come into this world knowing exactly what we want. Those little things know they want to eat the peas, but they don't want to eat the carrots. They want to stand on the high chair. They don't want to sit in the high chair. They want to wear the shorts. They don't want to wear the pants. They know exactly what they want minute to minute. To quote a line from the song, you've got to be carefully taught. But once you are taught, once we learn that decisiveness is dangerous in our system, then we put a fog in our brain about what we want. Our brain, our unconscious, creates a fog between what we want and our knowing it, so that we begin to believe that we don't know what we want. It wasn't true, and it isn't true, but it is our experience, powerful experience, in this particular case, that we actually don't know what we want. So, of course, so much of the work I do in therapy is about helping people figure out what it is they had to deny. And often, it's exactly that thing that they had to deny that they already have that is what is getting in their way in the present, why they came into therapy in the first place. We don't have to create something new. We just have to unearth what's already there. And I guess while I'm talking about it, I ought to say that for the last 10 or 12 years, I have done virtually my entire practice on the telephone. And if you're interested in that, you can go up on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynnesshow, thelynshow.com. There is, by the way, another The Lynn Show. So look for the one where you see the radio show, because you can get the podcasts from the radio show, the podcast of the show I'm doing right now, and Steve Druckmann's interview, which I'm going to do in a minute, and all the shows I ever did. But you can also find out about my therapy practice, the book I wrote. Whatever you want to know about me, it's on that website. So today I am playing an interview with Stephen Druckmann. Stephen's interview for me is really interesting, because Stephen discovered, and you'll hear this story, I'm not going to preempt it because it's so interesting, and you can hear how startled I am by it in the interview. Stephen discovered at the age of 4 the impact that what he calls fiction can have on altering how we feel, how we perceive the world, how we experience ourselves. And that began essentially a lifelong attempt to figure out what form Stephen's talent, interest in words, really obsession with words and ideas, would take. And in the short run, which is to say, I think, if I remember correctly, virtually until he was graduating from graduate school, I think this is correct, he didn't know that the form that it had to take would be the perfect form for him. What he actually was a playwright. He wrote in any number of other ways, had very prestigious careers, and still does. But then his unconscious presented him with the information that what he really is a playwright. And so although he still teaches and he still writes erudite and philosophical treatises and he still does all other kinds of other things, as you can hear, he's written 15 plays. And the reason that I got to interview Stephen is that the world premiere of his play, The Innocents, is playing now at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida. It was chosen out of 5 plays that were done in the Unplugged Play Festival last year. The Oslo does a 5-play, the readings of 5 new plays, and then chooses one to have a full production in the following year. And The Innocents was chosen last year, and it is having its world premiere full production as we speak. Unfortunately, there are only 4 more days to get down there and see it, and I really suggest you get there and see it. It's a very interesting, very intriguing, very unusual play, but then so is Stephen Druckman. And you can hear that for yourself as I am going to play the interview. And after the interview, well, I'll tell you about that. I'm going to play Pam Wiley's review of The Innocents. But now, here, Stephen Druckman. So I'm here with Steve Druckman in a conference room at the Oslo Repertory Theater building. And Steve is here for the world premiere of his play, The Innocents, which had a reading at the Unplugged series last year.
That's correct.
And was chosen as the one to have a full production of, right?
That is correct.
And so next week? Is it next week?
Yes, a week from Friday we open.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
First preview is a week from today, I guess, or a week from tomorrow.
It's great.
Yeah, I'm thrilled.
I'm sure. Although this is not your first experience, Lepidus.
No, I mean, I've been very lucky that my plays, I've written about a dozen, I've written about probably 15 plays, some that I don't ever want to be produced, but the ones that I want to be produced get produced, and so I am really lucky.
And grateful.
And incredibly grateful.
I know.
Yeah, no, it's to be able to do what you love, and you know, no one gets to do what they love, so, and I do love writing plays, so.
Well, I want to hear a lot more about that. I do an interview series called Anatomy of an Artist. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I always ask the same question. And that is, how did it happen? How did it start? What was the beginning?
Well, my earliest memory is a theatrical one, I think. Or I attribute it to my love of theater. I was in nursery school, and...
Nursery school, 3, 5?
I was probably 3 or 4 years old, mm-hmm. And I had a skirmish on the playground, and I defended myself, but I also had some cuts and bruises. I got in trouble, and I went to the, I guess she was the principal, and I went to her office, and I was sobbing. I mean, I was really distraught and inconsolable, and she was cleaning my wounds with witch hazel, and she was sort of a scornful not a pleasant woman. And
witch hazel, it might have hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I was really sobbing. I mean, I really was in a terrible state of mind. And I remember, it was a very old building, and the pipes made this whistling sound. And I looked, and she had a cameo brooch. And somehow, I put together this idea that the cameo brooch was, you know, the silhouette was whistling, making that whistling noise. And almost instantly, I went from racked sobs to convulsive laughter. And I remember thinking, wow, that's the power of, I didn't have this sophisticated thought,
right.
But I thought, that's the power of imitation, that something, enacting something, can change our point of view immediately. Isn't that a powerful and wonderful thing? Since then, I've been smitten with theater.
My God!
In one way or another, yeah. You know, as a kid, I put on puppet shows. It was my favorite thing to do. I had a puppet theater.
Kid, 6, 8, 10?
Yeah, 6, 8, 10, all of that.
So you didn't have this is really interesting to me, because what most people say is, I saw this performance, I saw this movie, my parents acted out this thing, my older sister was in a play, but this is none of that. This is all inside you.
Yeah.
That is so remarkable.
Yeah, I remember having that sort of, you know, four-year-old epiphany that you can be distracted from your current pain,
yes,
your current worldview, by something that is fiction. I knew it was fiction. I knew the brooch wasn't actually whistling, but I noticed how it changed my mood so much.
I am absolutely fascinated by this. I think this is amazing, because of course it's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the correct conclusion to come to, it seems to me anyway, from that experience, and yet it's as, I mean, you said, you know, you didn't have that sophisticated a thought at that, but I think it's a tremendously sophisticated thought.
Maybe.
For a child to, well, okay, great.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm quite taken by it. I think it's quite remarkable.
Well, that's what we've done with the theater for millennia, is that we go and we distract ourselves and we want to see something that we know is not real, played out before us, and for some reason, since the Greeks, we get something out of it. It takes us out of our everyday misery. And
you know, sometimes it dumps us into it, but never mind.
It can do that, but in sort of making us face our everyday misery, it does something else too. It enlightens us. It uplifts us too.
Theoretically, it's cathartic.
Yes, although I don't like that word, but
why?
Because catharsis is one of those words that is troubled by so many different interpretations. I don't. You know, I teach Aristotle at NYU. When I teach playwriting, I'm pretty strictly Aristotelian, but we don't really know what Aristotle meant by catharsis when he said that the tragedy must excite this catharsis. We don't know if he meant a purging of the elements of the plot, or if he meant something that we all must go through together.
Or that each individual could go to by themselves.
Yeah, there could be individual catharses, I suppose, it's just one of those troubled terms that I don't always use.
You're saying that you're not exactly sure what it means or what I mean when I use it? Or if I use it, that you wouldn't have the same definition?
Perhaps it's more the same.
So I'll be more clear then.
Okay.
That theoretically, experiencing something that scares you or hurts you or enrages you, but has closure, allows you to experience that and not be stuck with it, and to get it out of yourself.
Yes.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, I would buy that. I really buy that.
Okay.
I had an experience recently, not to talk too much, but I had this experience recently where I was in New York in winter, and this piece of ice fell from the building very close to me, and I could have been killed, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no experience of it. I didn't see it happening. I didn't really feel anything. But people around me in New York wanted to touch me afterwards, make sure I was okay. And I could see that that experience meant something more to them than it meant to me. It was something cathartic that mm-hmm. way.
Right.
That feeling of there but for the grace of God go I. Yes. It was a little theater event for them, yes. you know.
So, okay, we have you at 3 years old mm-hmm. having this epiphany. And the next significant thing that you're aware of in terms of your relationship to creating fiction mm-hmm. Is the puppets?
Yes, I put on puppet shows.
Did your parents buy that for you? Did you ask for it?
I inherited it from a cousin, I remember. And I just loved it. I didn't have to do it for anyone. I mean, I could enact them in my basement for an imaginary audience. And I was always writing. I wrote poetry a lot as a kid. I wrote songs as a kid. I mean, they were probably dreadful. In fact, I know the poems were because I recently unearthed some of them. But I have to say, to my credit, they did have this kind of Chekhovian wisdom to them somehow. You know, at 9 years old, I'm writing this poetry that has to do with the fact that life passes us by and time goes on and we become old people and we don't do anything with our lives. I don't know where that came from, but somehow that kind of that existential concern was already there at 9 years old.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
So, when did you, do you know when you said to yourself, I'm a writer?
I didn't allow myself to be a writer for a while, and even longer than that, I didn't allow myself to be a playwright. I knew I loved the theater, and the only way I knew into the theater was to be an actor. I think a lot of playwrights are former actors for that reason. It's sort of their gateway drug into playwriting. And I was an actor and was getting a lot of work in Chicago for a long time.
Oh, wait, go back. That would mean you studied, you majored, you something.
That's
just
right.
Tell me.
Yeah. I was... I acted in high school. I was sort of the actor in my high school, and
so you were pretty much always a pretty dramatic guy.
I was. It probably, you know, even started before that 3-year-old memory. I was adopted, and I learned only years ago that my birth parents met doing theater. So they were both engaged in the theater, and so anyway.
So you came in with it.
So I think it's pretty much imprinted in my DNA.
Yeah, I think it's clear.
Yeah.
Right.
So yeah, so I was an actor in high school, and then.
And the people who raised you, did they understand this? Did they support it? Did they?
Yeah, they came to understand it when it was clearly a concern.
When it was inevitable.
Yeah, when it was inevitable, and they've always been incredibly supportive people. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness for them. So they've supported me every step of the way when I was an actor and then my next career and then the playwriting. I mean, there's been.
So you were acting in high school, and then did you decide to study it? And
I went to Oberlin College,
mm-hmm.
and I was a theater major there, and did all the plays again. And graduated and went to Chicago to be an actor, and was an actor, was working as an actor for a while. And I met my first really sort of serious boyfriend in Chicago, and he was a playwright, Scott McPherson, who wrote Marvin's Room. I don't know if you remember that film or that play. Yeah. And because I think of the sort of natural division of labor in couples, I thought, well, he's the playwright, I guess I'm really the actor. And I didn't allow myself to ever conceive of myself as a playwright.
Let me I'm just curious. Do you know why? I mean, was it hubris?
Hubris that I started writing plays?
No, God.
Well, it is. That is why I started writing plays, was hubris, but...
No. See, I'm thinking it was hubris that you thought it would be, I don't know, it's probably not a word, hubristic.
Mm-hmm. That is a word.
Is it?
Yeah,
right. So, that you thought it would be hubristic to think of yourself as a playwright?
Yeah, I think I always wanted to I always wanted to write, and I knew I had some talent at it, and I think I knew I wanted to write plays, but I saw what he was going through. The playwrights are really put through the ringer with first drafts and workshops and readings and yeah. producers who want to change your script and actors who want better lines.
And directors who think they know what they're doing.
Exactly. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And as hard as the theater is, I thought, well, playwriting is probably the most thankless job in all of theater. Let him do that, and I'll continue doing the acting, which I really enjoyed. So that was mainly what kept me from writing plays. And then I went on to get the PhD
in
performance studies, but still theater stuff. And the part I loved about scholarship was the writing. And to support myself through getting the PhD, I became a journalist. And I was writing for smaller outlets in New York until finally I was writing for the New York Times.
Mm.
And I was...
You're still not calling yourself a writer?
That was sort of when it changed. I thought, yeah. Well, I guess...
My God, I must be a writer.
I guess I'm a journalist.
Right. Let's not go all the way to...
Right. I didn't allow myself to be a creative writer at all, but yeah. I really loved... I loved being a journalist and loved writing and just sort of churning out words. And what happened was when it came time to write the dissertation for my PhD, I faced the dilemma, you know, I have these two careers. Am I going to be an academic? And should I write this dissertation? Or should I just continue with writing for the New York Times and editing and being freelance for all these places? And in the midst of that sort of quandary, this play just emerged out of my unconscious. And that's really how it happened. I just started taking dictation from these characters in my head. And suddenly that sort of false quandary of, am I a journalist or am I a scholar, disappeared. And I realized, wow, suddenly this late in life, this is what I really want to be. This is what I think I'm meant to be.
This is actually who I am.
Yeah, this is who I am. And... And the die was cast.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
So that play wrote itself.
It did, and that's what I mean about hubris, is that it wrote itself. I sent it to an agent who said, yes, I'll represent you. He sent it to the Mark Tabor Forum in Los Angeles. They said, yes, we'll stage it in our new work series. They sent it to the Long Wharf Theater. They said, yes, we'll produce it. And I thought, well, that's easy. Playwriting is so easy. Had I known that you can just write a play and not know anything about it, it'll just be suddenly produced. And I had some beginner's luck, I think, because...
There's no question that you had some beginner's luck,
yeah.
But it must have been... I don't know what the play was.
It was called Going Native,
mm-hmm.
And it was, like a lot of first efforts, somewhat autobiographical and funny, and just it had appeal to...
Clearly.
To audience,
yeah, clearly. I mean, yes, you were lucky, but that's... all these people wanted to do something with it. That's not luck.
Yeah, I suppose.
No.
But honestly, I didn't know what I was doing. I had no skills as a player. If anyone had said to me, what is this character's action? What is the main conflict? Where's the event on this page? I wouldn't have understood any of that. I had no craft. And
well, but what you must have had from all the plays that you had done and all the plays that you had read... You must have had it inside without having labels for it. Hmm?
I think that's right. It
yeah.
was pure intuition.
Right.
I had the feeling of what a play was, the shape of it was, what it would look like on the page, how to get from point A to point B.
So there were events, and there were motivations, and there were actions, and you just didn't know what they were.
I just didn't know
what
they were.
You know what to call them, right.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. And so my craft part of playwriting I've been a total autodidact. I mean, that has just been my teaching myself over.
Yeah, that was what my next question
yeah.
was. What did you do?
I just taught myself how to write plays.
So what are you saying, that you read books? Or you read more plays? Or
I did read a couple playwriting manuals, the good ones all say the same thing. And, you know, I was a PhD and I was teaching at NYU, but they were more academic classes. And eventually it became clear to the administration, well, he's writing all these plays and they're getting produced, but he's teaching this sort of arcane, you know, academic stuff.
Well, what were you teaching?
Well, I was teaching postmodern theory and some post-structuralism, and I was teaching the survey class in theater history, which I do still teach at NYU and love teaching. I was teaching sort of modern drama history classes, that sort of thing. But it became clear that you should teach playwriting.
I was just going to say.
And I said, well, I think I should learn playwriting first. I wouldn't know really how to teach it unless I really had...
Unless you say, sit down and listen to your unconscious.
Well, that is a large part of playwriting. That's a very important part of playwriting. Because if you pay too much attention to the rules and structure, then you've got a lifeless, inorganic play. If a play doesn't mean something, it isn't coming from your unconscious, an audience knows it. It just doesn't come off the page somehow. And that's the thing that's almost it's impossible to teach.
I just want to corroborate that's impossible to teach because one has to have permission, one has to feel safe enough to get in touch with that and to allow it to come through, and that's not something that can be taught.
No. It isn't. I mean, I can lecture about that, but to have my students be able to put themselves in a room and access that stuff, there's nothing I can do.
But you know, that's the same with actors.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that's the same with any art.
I think so.
You know, that's the most compelling art is universal because it's real. Right?
Right.
You know, I mean, this is just a cliche, obviously.
No, but I think it's really true.
Mm-hmm. But of course, I was being slightly facetious when I said, you know, just listen to you.
I know.
Right.
But
you know, that's what you knew when you started to write. That's what you knew. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you started to teach playwriting.
Yes, and I still do. And I teach the rules, the structural rules of playwriting, which is half the battle. I mean, you have to set up your hero on a quest with some big wants, needs, desires. You have to give him or her impediments to reaching those desires. You have to learn how to structure reversals to your protagonist getting what he or she wants. And finally, ultimately, they have to end up getting something they didn't expect when they started out on the journey. That's really the what you have to do structurally for a play. But it won't mean anything unless you are contending with questions, concerns, fears, neuroses maybe, that plague you as a writer, that are sort of constantly on your windscreen, bubbling up from your unconscious. You have to learn to sort of mash the two together.
Harness it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because all the structure in the world will just make a lifeless, formulaic play.
You know, I don't know why, but it seems to me that actually what you are is a philosopher.
Well, yeah, playwrights were philosophers originally. And
I mean, because you're so interested in ideas for their own sake. That's how it feels. Maybe that's wrong.
No, that is true. I love dramatizing ideas in the form of people with real needs and wants. You know, if it's just ideas, the play will be really arid. But if you have people who are keyed into wanting and needing something, it will be emotional. And that a play, above all else, has to move us, has to move from emotion to emotion to emotion. And the really good playwrights, the playwrights who interest me, you know, like Tom Stoppard is a philosopher.
Yes, he is.
But he knows how to write people with needs and wants in his best plays.
You know, at the end of Arcadia, I was hysterical. I don't even know why.
Right.
You know?
Right. Well, that's it. That's
right.
The art of playwriting.
I mean, I was just completely gone.
Right. That's what makes him Tom Stoppard.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay. So you found this. You knew it when you found it. That's the other kind of interesting thing about you, is you do seem to know it when you see it.
Yeah.
You know, you can avoid it, you can hide from it, you can pretend it's not there, but when you see it, you don't run from it.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. That's because it would have been easy for me to say, well, I wrote this play, but I have these other two careers already cooking along.
Well, you had three or four.
Well, I had been, and I'd sort of given up the acting.
You had acting, you had, I mean...
Right, that's right. I mean, I was teaching the journalism. And, but I think it's in... What gets very hard about writing, and I'm sure you've discovered this with other writers you've spoken to, is finding the courage, again, to sort of allow yourself to access your unconscious and believe that it's worthwhile.
Yes, I think that's right.
To believe that anyone wants to hear what you have to say, any sort of yarn you care to spin, the ideas that you have. And I'm not sure that gets any easier. It might even get harder the more you write. I think it was John Gardner who said about fiction, he says, you know you're really a writer when it starts getting really hard. He says that's when you know you can call yourself a writer.
Because the early stuff is just what's on the surface? Because it's so what's most easily accessible?
I think it's that you expect more. You have to keep raising the bar.
Yeah.
And that means digging deeper and deeper.
Wow.
And going further each time. And I assume that's what he meant by it, because writing does get harder, even as I master the craft, although some critics would disagree with that. But, you know, as I get better at the craft anyway, it does get harder to find the courage, in a sense, to look at my demons again.
Yes. This is really interesting to me, because I pretty much believe that, maybe that's not true what I was going to say. I was going to say that the primary demons are, we just keep dealing with them. Sometimes there are demons under demons. But for a lot of people, it's the demon that never really gets quiescent, you know, never gets the wound that never gets healed.
Right.
And I'm fond of saying you're never going to be someone who didn't have your history.
Right.
So then your history continues to be your history. So your demon continues. Do you know what I mean?
That's right, yeah.
So I wonder if it's possible really to write that out. Do you know what I mean? To be done with it, to have nothing more to say about it, then what does one do?
Good question. You know, one would stop writing, I suppose, and one doesn't want to stop writing if one loves writing.
Exactly.
And so there's a disincentive to really uncovering, you know, that final demon.
Interesting dilemma.
It is a dilemma.
Yes.
Well,
you haven't run out yet, apparently. Apparently, you have not done it in. Or
I hope not. But you know, I'm trying to write a new play right now, and it's sometimes I feel like there's no toothpaste left in the tube. I just keep squeezing, and it's just there's nothing there. And then, you know, I'll go away I'll leave it alone for a month or something, and then suddenly, my unconscious will tell me the way through. The answer is always in here. It's and you have to get better, more patient, and learn to just sort of to wait for it. The trick is not to write too early and try to control it and
force it,
yeah, make it something it really isn't.
You know, two things occur to me here. One of them is rather a, I don't know, frivolous example, but I love jigsaw puzzles, but I always have the same experience. That is, I will work on it for a while, and then I can't see anything.
Right.
And I'm sure there are pieces missing. And I go away, and I come back, and suddenly I see things I didn't see before, and I don't know why.
Right. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Right.
Crossword puzzles the same way. You know, you just, if you can put it down and then come back to it, you're a different person an hour later. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that leads me to the second thing. I'm a songwriter, and I didn't write a song for 15 years, and I thought, well, that's that. But it wasn't.
Right.
15 years later, a song decided it needed to be written.
Oh, it's great to hear.
You know? And not only that, but I quite often have had the experience of, this is the best song I will ever write. I will never write a better song than this. But I do. Or I have. I don't know that I will. I don't, a little bit of hubris here.
Right.
But I've had that experience, you know, over and over. But again, I think it's what you're talking about, patience and courage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's why every, you ask a playwright, you know, what's your favorite play of yours, and it's always the last one they've written, because they think that's the one, I finally sort of uncovered who I am, and this is the one that I want to stand as my definitive play, and then they'll write the next play, and they'll forget about that child a little bit.
That's right.
Yeah.
Something about the, but if you're writing from that place, it seems to me, if you're not writing from that place, then it doesn't matter that much. When did you write The Innocence?
The Innocence I wrote over a summer.
Do you want to say a little bit about what it's about, or you don't want to?
Sure, I don't mind. It's a play that is, I think it's a romantic comedy, sort of in the fashion of Noel Coward, but it is distinctly 21st century Noel Coward. It's a family play about a new sort of family, a middle-aged gay man and his best friend, a woman, who want to have a baby, their baby, together, and rear the child as a new family. And two younger people come into their lives and entangle their plans, and things start to unravel a bit, that's really all I'll say on the level of plot.
Right, yes,
yeah.
You won't tell us about the rehearsals and how
people
get where they were going, but they didn't know they were.
No, I won't tell you any of that.
That's great.
Because I want people to see it.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, I like to ask, having given a life to helping alter what people are feeling, from the brooch and the pipes on, what are you thinking?
I never really think of it that way, that there's this sort of awesome power of the writer to alter what people are feeling or thinking. I mean, of course, that is why we do what we do, but when you put it in such sort of grand terms...
It's the through line of what you've been doing.
Yeah, I suppose it's...
You're still not going to... You still don't want to take credit for it, right?
You know, I don't...
Do you know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying. It's something in me that shies away from
it's all right.
That I'm doing that.
Fine, you can define it however you want.
No, but I think that is what we do. I mean, you know, actors and playwrights, people especially in the theater, but all artists are saying, you know, pay attention to me in somehow and let me affect you.
Mm-hmm.
Actors do it in a more performative, you know, sometimes look at me kind of way, and playwrights get to sort of delude themselves a bit because they're not seen up there. They're just putting these characters in motion and these stories up there. So I think you're right. Sometimes I fool myself and think, well, that's really all I'm doing is sort of writing. So I'm not affecting anybody.
Yeah, you know? Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Yeah, in a sense, you do sort of feel that way. But it's, yeah, it's true. I guess I am doing that.
So having spent a life in whatever way you construct it, however you feel about it, do you want to just think about it for a second and see if there's something you want to say about what it's like to have dedicated a life to words, to performance, to the creation of things that weren't there before, to the tapping of the demon, to the altering of consciousness, to, you know?
Yeah. Well, because I came to playwriting as an avid lover of theater, someone with a PhD who saw what theater meant and has meant to every culture, from the Greeks to the freaks, is what I say, from the Greeks to the present, to be able to take part in that and believe that it's important, that you're offering a group of people who may not want to be there. I go to the theater all the time. I don't always want to be there. But the sort of the possibility of some sort of narrative of redemption or even some sort of distracting entertainment is really a kind of humbling and gratifying thing when you know how important it has been and always will be, it seems. Theater or the art of imitation is something, imitation is just who we are as human beings. It's what we crave, what we desire. The powerful imitators in every culture are revered and sometimes feared. And so it's really humbling to sort of be able to think that you're doing that even on the smallest scale with a very small audience.
I was thinking while you were talking that I was feeling sad. I don't remember the context in which I was feeling sad now, but I was having a hell of a time kicking it, and I was in New York, and I was going to the theater, and I went down to TKTS, and there were several choices, and I picked The Drowsy Chaperone, and 10 minutes in, I thought to myself, well, this is what the theater is supposed to do, because
yeah.
I was feeling great, you know.
That's right.
It just, I mean, it was my version of the brooch and the...
That's right.
And the pipe, you
That's
know,
exactly
I mean, suddenly
right.
it just turned itself around,
That's right?
I left the theater happy.
That's right.
Nothing had changed about whatever it was I was sad about, right?
Right.
Right.
But you had a change of perspective.
I did.
Yeah, exactly.
And so for all of us who experience that at your plays, we are grateful.
Thank you. It's kind of you to say.
No. This has been wonderful. Thank you very much,
Stephen. Thanks. It was my pleasure.
And of course, it was my pleasure because as a therapist, talking to anybody who understands, believes, honors, trusts, yearns towards the unconscious is, a gift. And truthfully, lots of people who make their living or their life are intimately connected to their unconscious, but not all of them are as aware of it as Steve Druckmann is. Using it, understanding, believing that it is a source for him, and not only believing that it is a source for him, but believing that there's a value to understanding, to delving, to mining, to discovering what might be hidden there, what we might have had to hide, I think that that's kind of what he meant when he was talking about demons, because sometimes people hide things which are valuable, significant, important. I mean, I've had clients who have hidden their intelligence from themselves, who don't know how smart they are, how beautiful they are, how competent they are. They have had to hide that. And then intelligence, competence, beauty come to feel like demons, because whatever the reason was you had to hide it, it was dangerous. And anything that's dangerous can be seen as a demon. So the willingness to look for those things you had to hide, even though they seem to be demonic. Of course, in a way, that is the entire point of this show, that we have had to hide things about ourselves because we felt they were dangerous, that they would get us into trouble, that they were ugly. And I am, as I was talking about at the beginning of the show, and as I talk about in every show, it is my mission to keep presenting the fact that hiding aspects of ourselves from ourselves, even if you can't use it in a play and make a life out of it, right? Which, fortunately for Stephen, he can. But even if you just recover them for yourself, you are more fully yourself. You have more energy than you used to have, because it takes energy to suppress. And unfortunately, ironically, much of the time, the things we recover are wonderful, necessary, essential to our well-being. So, enough of my soapbox. I'm going to play Pam Wiley's review of The Innocents, which, if you can get to Sarasota to see, you absolutely should. I'm reading it, so if it sounds like my voice, it is, but Pam sent me the review and I'm reading it. And I think that's it for now. So, here, Pam Wiley's review of Stephen Druckman's The Innocents. Intriguing in its premise, ingenious in its execution, and impeccably directed, performed, and produced, The Innocents offers an intimate look into a 21st century family friendship. Chosen from five plays developed during the Oslo Repertory's 2010 Unplugged New Play Festival, The Innocents is about relationships, parenthood, and love. Written by Stephen Druckman as a darkly comic mystery, its main focus is being, quote, innocent about our own innocence, unquote, to quote the playwright. The family unit at the center of the play is made up of a middle-aged gay man, played by Judge Williford, whose name is Sutter, and his closest female friend, Edie, played by Kate Hampton. Together, they have been unsuccessfully trying to have a baby through artificial inseminations. Into this situation come two very appealing men, Daniel, played by Jason Bradley, and Laron, played by Scott Kearns. Daniel for Edie, Laron, an Israeli for Sutter. The strong performances enrich the characters and bring even more reality to them. Self-absorption reigns over these characters as they work hard to manipulate their lives and the lives of others to meet all their desires. Edie and Sutter are trying to create a new kind of family. The appearance of Daniel, who has a flirtation and relationship with Edie, and Laron, who has a flirtation and relationship with Sutter, threatens the stability of the relationship that Edie and Sutter are trying to create. Each character insists on defining life in their own terms. They refuse to compromise. Individual happiness and self-realization is not negotiable, and they keep on playing their games even though they know they will probably eventually get hurt. In the end, it is a matter of trusting each other. They have no choice. The play takes place mainly on an attractive set designed by Lee Savage and nicely lit by Tyler Michelou. Amy J. Chianti designed the suitable costumes, and Matthew Parker's sound design is most appropriate. now running at the Oslo Repertory Theater in Sarasota, Florida, through May 14th in the Cook Theater. Call the box office, 941-351-8000, or toll-free at 800-361-8388. So, if that review didn't make you want to come down and see it, let me give one more plug for it. It's really worth seeing. It's interesting, it's compelling, and you won't be sorry. So, if you are in Florida, anywhere near South Florida, or you're planning to come here on vacation, get tickets, come on down, see The Innocents. That's pretty much the end of the show. I will one more time, more than one more time, I will tell you my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. And as I said before, you can listen to all the podcasts of the last 3 years. There's a list on the side of the first page of my website that gives categories. So if you wanted to listen to other playwrights, you could click on playwrights or actors or musicians or artists. Or if you're interested in the concepts from my book, they are also listed there, and the shows in which I have talked about them are there. Access to the book, the workbook, the audiobook, all there. As always, I need to thank Josh Hackney, without whom, as I often say, Josh, who is conversant with recording, computers, electronics, any of those things that so many of us need, and so many of us, although we need them, cannot do. Josh can create them, he can fix them, he can teach them, he can reteach them and reteach them, which is what he often has to do for me. And if you need any of that kind of help, you want Josh Hackney, and you can get him at thelynshow.com. Just go up there, click on email me, say I want Josh, or email me anything that you want to say. Comment on the show, ask me a question, come into therapy with me. You can also follow The Lynn Show on Twitter, on LinkedIn, on Facebook. And I have somebody working on a Lynn Show app, if you can believe it. Anyway, as always, I hope that you heard something you can use in this show. Something that intrigued you or got your attention or even made you slightly uncomfortable, as long as it brings you back. Because I will be here next week, and as always, I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, fight, no, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, dang, no. rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Fiend